I'm a loom fixer. My daddy was a fixer too.
I'm Ellen Furman, and this is Strike, a documentary series about the 1929 textile strike in Marion, North Carolina.
If I die before my shift is through, well, I'll pray the cotton dust carries my soul back to you.
The strike at Marion was front page news across the country. Sinclair Lewis filed reports from the scene.
The history of the 1929 strikes at the Marion Manufacturing Company and the Clinchfield Mills at Marion, North Carolina, is told here. It is the strike in which deputy sheriffs fired upon textile mill workers, with the unfortunate result that five, so far, are dead and more than 20 wounded.
Woody Guthrie wrote two sets of lyrics about the events at Marion.
The Marion Massacre. A story now I'll tell you of a fearful massacre which happened down in Dixie. 'Twas in Marion, North Carolina. In a little mountain town, six workers of a textile in cold blood were shot down.
Ann Swan is a McDowell County historian and curator of the Carson House Museum in Pleasant Gardens.
When folks talk about the 1929 strike, they usually think of the one that happened in Marion in McDowell County at what was called the Marion Manufacturing Company. But actually, that was just one strike that was occurring throughout the South along about that period of time. The one in Marion generated a lot of interest because there were fatalities involved.
Mike Lawing, author of The Marion Massacre, sets the stage by painting a picture of the world in 1929.
Well, 1929 was a capstone of the end of what was called Coolidge prosperity. The stock market had a fantastic year in 27 and 28. People who didn't know anything were making money hand over fist in the stock market. The economic wisdom of that time was that this is never going to end. There's a worldwide demand for American goods, and because of this worldwide demand, we're going to keep selling things, prices are going to keep going up, and there's nothing that's going to stop it. When Hoover ran in the 28 election, his campaign promise was two chickens in every pot and a car in every garage. Radio was kind of in its infancy at that time. North Carolina only had four radio stations spread out all over the state. Two of them were in western North Carolina. One was in Charlotte and one was in Asheville. Talkies were coming in. There's a movie theater in Marion called the House Theater that's right behind the courthouse. That theater was there in 29. And the advertisements in 29 were saying, all talking picture. You know, Lindbergh had gone across the Atlantic and he was still making news. Admiral Byrd flew over the South Pole that year.
Also becoming part of the landscape in 1929 were the textile strikes that were sweeping the Southeast. Elizabethton, Tennessee erupted in March, followed by Greenville, South Carolina, then Mills in North Carolina. By July of that year, 13 mills in three states were the scene of strikes. Just 75 miles from Marion in Gastonia, workers at the Luray Mill walked out in April. In June, Gastonia Chief of Police Adderholt was shot dead during a confrontation outside Union headquarters. And a few months later, outspoken poet and mill worker Ella Mae Wiggins was murdered. Although each strike had its own unique root causes, the source of much worker dissatisfaction, particularly in Marion, was the stretch out.
They were asking people to do more work, but not really providing more money for it. There's a fellow named Sam Finley who gives a very good description of what he thought about the stretch out. It's a direct quote. They got a stopwatch and they followed them around. They figured out exactly how long it took you to tie that thread and start up the loom. They figured right down to the tick of that stopwatch. Then they expected you to stretch it out a little bit, do a little bit more. You couldn't please them. The more you done, the more they wanted done.
Woody Guthrie also made note of this productivity-increasing device in the lyrics to The Marion Strike.
You heard of the stretch-out system. Going through this country today, they put us on two men's jobs and just give us half enough pay.
In addition to the stretch-out, living conditions in the Marion Manufacturing Mill Village were also throwing fuel on the fires of discontent.
The Marion Manufacturing Company provides houses for its employees. I have examined these houses with considerable care. Their water supply comes from old-fashioned hand pumps, with not even enough pumps. Usually there is one pump to two houses, of which each holds from 2 to 12 people.
Again, author Mike Lawing.
Lewis, in 1929, was at the top of his game. He was the most popular writer in the United States at that time. In 1930, he became the very first American to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. So this is just a few months before that happened. And most of his books dealt with Midwestern values. His novels are Dodsworth, Main Street, Arrowsmith, Elmer Gantry. Everybody remembers Burt Lancaster playing that role. But he decided he wanted to write a new novel about the American labor movement. Now, when the shootings occurred in Marion, he decided, this is what I want to go down and take a look at. This is where I'm going to go and focus on this incident and make it a part of this novel. While he was here, he stayed at the Mariana Hotel in Marion. That was one of only two hotels in town at that time. It's right next to the courthouse. But he wrote six articles for Scripps Howard News, and then later on, all of those were condensed into a very short pamphlet called Cheap and Contented Labor. And he didn't particularly paint a nice picture of Marion. I don't think Marion, the Chamber of Commerce, would be too thrilled with some of his comments.
In one glimpse, on a visit to Marion Mill Villages, you can see that none of the houses has running water, or therefore toilets. The houses are all of them up on stilts, with no windbreaking foundations, whatever, so that if there were any water pipes, they could be seen. For toilets, there are ill-built privies, and of these, one often serves two families. The houses are of the cheapest and flimsiest construction. I have tried to pry the clapboards apart and have found that it could be done with my little finger. A four-room house in which 12 people may be living is just this. It is a box with an unscreened porch. It has three living rooms and a kitchen. In each of the living rooms, there are normally two double beds. In these double beds, there sleep anywhere from 2 to 5 people, depending on their ages.
I asked Black Mountain resident Max Price, son of Roy Price, a key union organizer at Marion Manufacturing, what he thought about Sinclair Lewis's portrayal of the situation in Marion.
It was difficult for him because he was an outsider. He wasn't accepted in Marion when he came there because he was looking to help the worker. He was up on his high horse most of the time through all of the articles.
Lewis reported that on his first night in Marion, a man went around town looking for him with a gun. General sentiment in Marion was anti-union, especially in the business community.
The mills were so connected to the banks and to each other. Marion Manufacturing and Clinchfield, the banks in town, all of these organizations shared common members of the board of directors.
The mill controlled the banks. The banks control the loans to small businessmen. The small businessmen are the best customers of the professional men, even when the latter are professional men of God. And so these mills can back up the whole human train down to the clerical caboose.
As mill workers were contemplating their options, they could not even be sure of receiving comfort at church. Again, McDowell County historian Ann Swan.
Some of the mill owners, or the powers that be, so to speak, had connections with some of the churches and had influence on some of the ministers so that they would, from the pulpit, promote anti-union sentiment. I do know that when the shootings occurred, they could not find a preacher to perform the funeral service.
The major churches in East Marion had all been started, actually, by the mills. And the people who were in these churches, who joined the union, in some cases, were excluded from the church as they were kicked out of the church. That is a tremendous loss to some people who felt that the church was a very, very important part of their life. And losing that was almost as bad as losing your job.
Many felt that working at the mill and living in the mill village was a step up from working on a farm.
Mill work was a leg up on farm work. A mill worker got paid every week. A farmer got paid when the crop came in, maybe twice a year. You could work all year and get nothing if the crop wasn't good. A mill worker worked 12 hours a day. A farmer worked 15 hours a day. So as bad as the conditions would look to people now, believe it or not, they weren't as bad as living on a farm. If you didn't make your crop, you could lose everything. You could go hungry.
Mostly to battle the stretch out, mill workers Sam Finley, Roy Price, and William Lawrence Hogan formed a committee to seek assistance from a union. They chose the United Textile Workers of America.
They didn't really know what they were doing, but they went to Asheville, to a place they described as the labor temple. And when they got there, they said, we want to get some help in organizing a union. And they were referred to a guy named Hoffman, and he told them to come back to Marion, told them how to begin organizing. He said, we'll come over there and we'll help you.
Roy Price, who worked in the card room at Marion Manufacturing, was the driving force and would ultimately become the president of the East Marion chapter of the United Textile Workers of America. Perhaps due to the tragic outcome of the strike, many of those most involved avoided discussing their actions for generations. Even though he was a key player in the Marion strike, Roy Price's role was unknown to his family until almost 50 years later. His son Max recalls when he found out.
My dad never talked about it. In 1976, there was a lady came to Asheville from Chapel Hill to interview my mother for the Southern Oral History Project. And in that interview, she asked if Dad wasn't involved in the union strike in Marion. And Mother said, yes. And that interview was the first time any of us knew about it.
Another son, Don Price, discovered the extent of his father's union activity in Marion only when an old trunk came to light. His wife, Jeanette, tells the story.
It was probably around 1978 or 79 when we first found out about the trunk. And it had been stored for around 50 years or more. And after we opened it, we found clothes and lace doilies and old books and photographs. And right in the bottom was a flattened box that nobody paid too much attention to. Then we began to sort through the papers in the old box, and we discovered it was material and records from the Marion strike.
By late spring of 1929, early labor meetings had begun in Marion. Classes were taught on organization and tactics, including the basic forms of harassment.
But the idea was that rather than just running around making a lot of noise by singing and creating a distraction, let's blow up some dynamite. That'll wake people up. That'll get their attention. So there was a lot of dynamite blast that went off, well, not so much to destroy anything, but as an intimidation factor. You were making a lot of noise at that time, right? Try to keep anyone from getting any sleep. That gave you a negotiating advantage. One thing that I thought was interesting, though, Atkins, the sheriff, lived in East Marion. One time when his daughter was sick, they purposely did not make noise around his house because they respected him, at least at that particular point, and wanted to let his sick daughter get some sleep.
By mid-June, the union was strong enough to hold an open meeting in the McDowell County Courthouse. Workers from Marion Manufacturing and from neighboring Clinchfield Mill packed the room. Again, author Mike Lawing.
The biggest mill in town was Clinchfield. Clinchfield employed more people than Marion Manufacturing. It had two great big factories and ran shifts. The living conditions in Clinchfield probably were not as good as the living conditions in East Marion. But Baldwin had irritated his people more than the people at Clinchfield had.
Partly because of mill owner Baldwin's arrogance. The union at that point was much stronger at Marion Manufacturing than at Clinchfield, which was located only about a mile away. While just 20% of Clinchfield's 1,500 employees were in the union, 80% of Marion Manufacturing's 650 employees were union members. In a meeting with the union about their demands, Baldwin went so far as to cavalierly offer $10 to each worker who would dare strike his mill. He also began firing the men most active in the movement and bringing in strikebreakers or scabs to replace them. After consulting with union headquarters, union leaders Roy Price and Lawrence Hogan were advised to try more negotiation. But by the time they got back, 600 workers had already walked out and in essence had shut the mill down. The strike had begun. From Cheap and Contented Labor by Sinclair Lewis.
Committees were elected to interview Mr. Baldwin, manager of the Marion Manufacturing Company. The demands were reduction of hours to 10 a day without decrease in wages. 22 of the most active complainers were fired. A strike was declared in both the Marion Manufacturing Company and the Clinchfield Mills on July 11, 1929. A certain amount of strike relief was provided by money sent down from the North. That relief might not seem altogether adequate for people who live soft. In the way of food, and understand that this was the only food on which the strikers and their families lived during the period of the strike. It consisted of flour, salt pork, coffee, rice, and occasional potatoes. But at least a dozen of the strikers have told me that they were content because this food is quite as good as what they can afford if they were working.
Union sympathizers from all over the country sent money, supplies, and moral support. Jeanette Price shares a letter that was found in the trunk containing Roy Price's union materials.
It's a letter from a lady in Kansas. Dear sir, enclosed find a money order for $1 to be used in sustaining the strikers. I am an old woman, not a member of any trade union, but I tithe my income, small but sufficient, and I feel perfectly clear that helping to promote social justice and working to advance the kingdom of God in this case appeals to me. With best wishes for your success.
They got support from Durham, North Carolina, from Philadelphia, from Atlanta, from Baltimore. People agreed to send them food. The railway workers over in Spencer, North Carolina, that's where the North Carolina Transportation Museum is, sent over a check for $600 to show unity with the people. The Asheville Trade Union also supported them. Norman Thomas, who had been the Socialist Party candidate in 1928, helped send some money down to him in 29. So he was concerned about him, and Roy Price was showing a check that had come from that direction, too. So money did start to come in, and it looked like they were possibly going to be able to solve something.
Baldwin left for New York 2 days after the strike began. When he returned a week later, a load of cotton and coal arrived, and he wanted it unloaded. He arranged for Marion Sheriff Oscar Atkins to lead foremen and strikebreakers across the picket line.
When Baldwin wanted to unload some rail cars, he had to cross a picket line and try to get some people to do that. Baldwin got hit by some strikers at that particular point. Atkins was with him, and the strikers kind of prevailed on that.
Sheriff Atkins had been in office less than a year and had been elected with the support of the mill workers. Before taking office, he operated a store in East Marion and provided credit to the mill workers. He was one of the few merchants in town that welcomed business from what some referred to as lint heads. He was even invited to speak at an early union meeting. He attended but declined to address the gathering. Shortly after the picket line incident at Marion Manufacturing, Atkins was called in to enforce evictions in Clinchfield, where union members were being fired and picket lines had also gone up.
The supervisor, superintendent, and owner at Clinchfield was a guy named Hart, and he was pretty hard-boiled. He was not going to have a union in his town, and he was actually heard to make the comment of, who in the heck are these people coming in here trying to, you know, stir our people up against us? We're going to get rid of this. But Hart decided that he was going to get people out of his village by eviction. He filled out the paperwork. He was more aggressive at that than Baldwin was at doing the paperwork. And the first evictions that came along were in Clinchfield rather than in East Marion. Atkins, the sheriff, had been given the paperwork to evict some families in Clinchfield and went over there to follow the court order. And he took some deputies with him. And the first house he went to evict him, the guy's daughter was sick, and Atkins just couldn't bring him. He wasn't going to throw a man out who had a sick daughter on the street. He just couldn't do it. So he said he'd come back later, and he let him go. He went on to the next guy on the list, and the next guy didn't want to be evicted and was giving him some problems and talked about how the mill still owed him money and Atkins said, well, I'll pay you what the mill owes you, to try to encourage him to go. But that didn't work either. And all it really did was sort of make Atkins look like he was kind of an agent for the mill rather than, you know, a man following the service of the whole county. But he looked around. There were about 400 people standing around watching him. And this group of people didn't like the fact that he was trying to evict some of them. And some deputies got pushed down some steps. They did get hurt. And he did leave there. And they were trying to turn his car over at the time he left. But they did get out of there without a real serious altercation. But some deputies were assaulted during that attempt to evict some people.
Evictions did proceed across Clinchfield. Rignall Baldwin did not issue any eviction notices in East Marion. But he achieved the same goal by increasing the rent for one of his mill houses from 20 cents per room per week to $1 per room per week. Most workers at Marion Manufacturing made around $13 per week, but now that most were on strike, they were earning nothing. By late August, almost all the Clinchfield employees were actively involved in the strike. They prevented the mill from reopening after a lockout. Management was presented with the same demands as Marion Manufacturing: reduction of hours to 10 per day without a decrease in wages, and rehiring of fired strikers. Clinchfield President Hart wired North Carolina Governor O. Max Gardner for troops. Rather than send in the National Guard, as he had done in Gastonia just months before, the governor tried another approach. Again, Mike Lawing.
He sent his close personal friend and advisor to Marion to hammer out a deal. He said, I want you to go up there. I want you to stop this thing. I don't want any violence. I want it to end. You go up there and you work it out. His name was N.A. Townsend. Nat came to Marion, got the people together, had a lot of meetings, lawyers, mill workers, tried to hammer out an agreement. The mill owners at some point decided they were going to walk out. And they showed up one day and just walked out and said, we're going home. We're not going to participate anymore. And Townsend laid the complete breakdown on the mill owners as their responsibility for the breakdown.
When a group of loyal workers, accompanied by Clinchfield plant superintendent Ed Henderson, attempted to enter the mill early one morning, they were roughed up. Judge Townsend, the governor's emissary, appealed to the strikers to disperse. They refused, and the judge threatened to call out the troops. The strikers began to chant, "Bring on the troops." By noon, 100 guardsmen drawn from Morganton and Asheville were camped on the McDowell County Courthouse lawn with their machine guns on display. From Cheap and Contented Labor by Sinclair Lewis.
The force of militia turned Marion into a concentration camp. They stopped every motor car that came through the main street of East Marion. They searched strikers and took away from them such dangerous weapons as pocket knives with blades 1 inch long.
My dad lived in the eastern part of McDowell County, and anytime you went to town in Marion, you rode in on what's now Highway 70. Went right through the middle of Clinchfield's on one side, East Marion's on the other. But he said as a boy about 9 years old, 1929, he was nine, riding down that road into town, seeing these guys wearing helmets, military uniforms, having rifles with bayonets on them, having machine guns. I mean, he said it really was an amazing sight to see. That the idea that that was right there in Marion was just very impressive to him as a young boy of 9 years old.
The workers responded to the presence of the National Guard with more dynamiting. Dynamite was planted on the Clinchfield Mill's switch tracks, rigged to explode when a railroad car passed. A lighted stick of dynamite was thrown at the house of an anti-union minister, but it failed to explode. A dynamite explosion caused $1,500 in damage in the opening room at Clinchfield. Mill management countered by escalating evictions in the Clinchfield Mill Village. One attempted eviction resulted in a riot and provided another embarrassment for Sheriff Atkins.
Clinchfield had moved a striker out of a house. They had effectively evicted him and moved a strike breaker into the house. And the union went over to that house and took every bit of furniture in it and put it out on the road. Mill owner called the sheriff in. He came down with some deputies to move the furniture back into the house. And this is when the riot in Clinchfield broke out. A lot of rocks were thrown. A lot of people were hit with sticks. Broad Robbins, who was the constable of Clinchfield and a deputy, was hit on the side of the head and received some serious injury to the side of his head and his ear.
When word reached Judge Townsend on a nearby golf course, he ordered the National Guard troops into Clinchfield Mill itself. Machine guns were placed in the mill windows. Once the guard was in the mill villages, they shut down all picketing. When Jim Owens, an anti-union employee at Marion Manufacturing, was injured in an altercation with a striker, he took to the streets of East Marion, firing a shotgun indiscriminately for nearly half an hour. Although stationed less than 50 feet away, the National Guardsmen did nothing to stop him. A six-year-old boy was injured by a ricocheting bullet. Despite the violence, a preliminary agreement between management and labor at Marion Manufacturing and Clinchfield was reached.
The hours were to be reduced to 55 a week. Wages were to be increased at the pleasure of the Marion Manufacturing Company, and since they have been honorably complied with this by increasing wages 5%, which must be a tremendous help to a man making less than $13 a week, and there was to be no discrimination against men who at that time belonged to the union.
Clinchfield Mill agreed to take back employees that had been fired due to union activity, but then declined to rehire them, claiming they had actually been fired for other reasons and so were not covered by the agreement. At Marion Manufacturing, Baldwin reserved the right to permanently dismiss 12 workers that had been the most active in the union. Soon after the settlement, Baldwin left town. In his absence, Adam Hunt, the superintendent at Marion Manufacturing, added over 100 names to the blacklist.
The employers at the Marion Manufacturing Company say that it is just a coincidence that they have not rehired the men who were most prominent in union affairs. That is because these men have proved upon scientific investigation of their careers not to be so brilliant as a mill worker ought to be if you are going to force a salary of $13 a week upon him.
Most of the union members who were rehired were placed on the night shift, and there was rumor of the night shift then being eliminated so they could be gotten rid of for good. In the early morning of October 2nd, 1929, a wildcat strike began at Marion Manufacturing. From the Marion Strike by Woody Guthrie.
So one word just brought on another, and the bullets, they started to fly. And after the battle was over, six men lay on the ground dying.
A steady rain was turning Baldwin Avenue, the dirt road that ran in front of Marion Manufacturing, into mud. The night shift was entering its final hours. The wildcat strike began not long after midnight. Some reports were that the strike was spontaneous. Mike Lawing's research has led him to believe that it was planned by workers who had lost their faith in the union and who were angered by mill management's decision to blacklist workers with union affiliation.
The circumstances that brought that on were the union left town that weekend before that. There was a labor conference in Rock Hill, South Carolina, to lay plans to try to organize the entire South within the United Textile Workers. And the labor leaders in Marion left and went to attend that. But a guy named Ed Johnson actually was the one who organized the Wildcat Strike. This is in the Raleigh News and Observer. Ed was not elected anywhere. And he was smart enough to where he didn't want to be elected to anything since he saw what had happened to the people who didn't have elected office. The other person who was very much a part of it was Randall Hall. Ed Johnson was one of the men who was not hired back. Randall Hall was. But Johnson put the strike together, and Hall was the inside man. Hall was going to go around and get everybody to leave the mill and walk out. He was going to do it. The tactic was, we're going to say that a mill superintendent precipitated it by harassing us for union activity. We're going to try to make it happen. If it doesn't happen, we're just going to do it and say it happened.
As soon as trouble started, Sheriff Atkins was summoned for what would be his last confrontation at the mill.
Ed Johnson and Atkins had known each other for about 14 years. And when Atkins got to the gate that night, he went up to Ed. He could tell that Ed was kind of the guy in charge. He said, what's going on? And Johnson was frank with him. He said, we are going to shut this mill down. We are going to cause them to assault us. And that way, we have a legal right to fight back if we can make them assault us first. And the fact that Johnson was just upfront about it with Atkins pretty well let Atkins know that this is the kind of trouble that's headed my way. These guys are going to start something.
Before Randolph Hall was forcibly removed from the building, he ran to each department in the mill encouraging a walkout. His fellow employees began to shut off their machines and to file outside to picket. Sheriff Atkins had been forewarned.
Atkins knew about it. He'd gotten a phone call as early as 9 o'clock that there was going to be something happen that night. The gatekeeper knew about it. The idea that something was going to happen was definitely in the air. Everybody knew that. So it's not a spontaneous thing. It's something that's being organized. And it's being organized outside of the elected officials in the union, and it's being organized outside of the organizers from the National Textile Workers.
Sinclair Lewis reported a different version of events.
One version has it that the mill foreman so taunted the workers, so badgered them, and told them that they dared not quit, that they began to walk out voluntarily at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Woody Guthrie wrote two sets of lyrics about the events of that morning.
The Marion strike. When they had that strike in North Carolina, up there at the Marion Mill, somebody called for the sheriff to come down there on the hill. The sheriff came down there to the factory and brought all of his men along, and he says to the mill workers, "Now, boys, you know this is wrong."
Sheriff Atkins had arrived with a handful of deputies and soon realized he was undermanned. Seven loyal Marion Manufacturing employees were deputized, including Jim Owens. He was the man who had had a recent altercation with a union member and had wandered East Marion recklessly firing a gun. Two other deputized mill workers had threatened strikers in the past, and another had been imprisoned for bootlegging. Tension simmered until dawn, when the day shift began to arrive.
The day force at the Marion Mill goes on at 7. It is a very curious thing that the workers, despite the charm of their company-owned houses, usually get to the mill and stand there gossiping long before the whistle blows. It may be quite true that from 6 to 7 on the morning of October 2nd, the crowd of mill workers gathered early for a wicked purpose. But whether they were wicked or good, whether they inclined to the Bolsheviks or the Rotarians, there they were at 6:45. You had there a brick building, not particularly large, employing only 600 men, with a decent grassy yard in front of it. You had a narrow road, and across from it, the building which combines the company office, the post office, and the company store. What happened then is a case for the sovereign state of North Carolina to decide.
Four different groups were converging on the mill gates. 150 picketing strikers, Atkins and his deputies, 200 loyal workers who wanted to go to work, and the mill supervisors who were just inside the gate. When a worker tried to pass through the gate to go to work, a striker grabbed his arm to restrain him. One of the newly deputized employees reportedly hit the striker with his pistol. Chaos ensued, and the sheriff, who had shown restraint up to that point, reacted.
The first thing that Atkins did was ask these people many times to disperse and leave. Then he decided that he had to do something to disperse it. He sent off a tear gas canister. Another deputy, Allie Stepp, set off a tear gas canister, and then Broad Robbins, who is the constable of Clinchfield, set off one. So there were three tear gas canisters dispersed. And while a lot of the tear gas did go into the crowd of strikers, some of it did blow back into the deputies. So it caused a lot of confusion with both groups of people. That's when the firing started.
I have heard that the crowd of strikers were an angry and heavily armed mob with sticks and revolvers, and I have heard that there wasn't a single gun among them. But so much is certain. The superintendent of the mills, Hunt, gave an invitation to all the strikers who wished to work to enter the mill. From the strikers, there were catcalls and curses. Tear gas was thrown by Sheriff Atkins and his men. Then the shooting started.
In the next 2 minutes, more than 50 shots were fired near the mill gate and in the muddy road out front. Bullets hit at least 30 strikers. 6 were fatally wounded.
So one word just brought on another, and the bullets, they started to fly. And after the battle was over, 6 men lay on the ground and died.
Again, Mike Lawing.
Sam Vickers died immediately right there in the road. James Randolph Hall, who had been the guy who went around and encouraged everyone to walk out, was shot 3 times. He was shot in the back, he was shot in the stomach, and he was shot in the leg. He was taken to the hospital and died very shortly after he arrived at the hospital. the third man who died in the hospital that same day was James Isaiah Jonas, and he was an old man, 65 years old.
There was much disagreement about how old man Jonas met his fate. Sinclair Lewis reported it this way.
When Sheriff Atkins threw tear gas at the strikers, old man Jonas, the striker nearest to Atkins, attacked him with a stick. Atkins was broad, fat, strong, about 40 years old, armed and supported by the majesty of the Carolina law which he represented. Beside Jonas was the distinguished constable, Broad Robbins, aged perhaps 50, but as powerful and menacing as a wolf. And old man Jonas was 68, and so lame with rheumatism that he had to walk with a cane, the cane with which he struck the sheriff. One would have thought that these two proud and powerful guardians of law and order would have been able to control old man Jonas without killing him. Indeed, they made a good start. Atkins wrestled with him, and Broad clouted him in the back of the head. Jonas fell to his hands and knees. He was in that position when he was shot. After the riot, Jonas, wounded fatally, was taken to the hospital with handcuffs on, was placed on the operating table with handcuffs still on, and straightaway he died on that table with his handcuffs on.
As soon as the tear gas was thrown, Jonas actually attacked Atkins with a stick and hit him. Other strikers came to his aid, other deputies came to Atkins' aid, and in this melee, Jonas was shot and died in the hospital that afternoon. There was a lot of controversy about whether Jonas was shot in the back or the front. The doctor who examined him first testified he was shot in the back, later testified he was shot in the front, and finally, in the last trial, he said he was shot in the back. Jonas was described by all of the mill workers who testified on his behalf as being a very old man crippled with arthritis. His stick was not an attack weapon. It was a walking stick. The deputies all said he was the strongest man they'd ever seen, that it took three of them to try to subdue him. So this is a big gap between your perspective of him.
Accounts of what exactly happened and who was doing the shooting varied widely, but it was all over in minutes. Once the dead and wounded had been transported from the scene, the employees of Marion Manufacturing did the only thing they knew to do. They went back to work. According to some reports, all but 100 mill workers walked stunned into the mill and took their places at their machines. That afternoon, a road drag came to scrape the blood off of Baldwin Avenue. As news of the Marion shootings reached the outside world, newspapers from all over the country sent reporters. On October 4th, 2 days after the shootings at Marion Manufacturing, a funeral was being held for four workers who had died. No church in the mill villages would open its doors to the strikers, so the service was held on a vacant lot near the mill, with coffins resting on sawhorses. The ministers who did speak were from out of town. The sound of machinery from Marion Manufacturing provided a backdrop for the services as the mill continued to operate throughout the proceedings. Word came during the funeral that a fifth man, James Will Roberts, age 18, had died of his injuries. On the day of the funeral, the preliminary hearing into the shootings at Marion Manufacturing got underway.
The original plan was to have a coroner's inquest. That got shut down pretty quick. Governor Gardner appointed William F. Harding to be a committed magistrate to oversee the hearing to determine if a murder had occurred and who should be charged with it. He held his hearing in the McDowell County Courthouse. There's no jury involved in here. We're just having a hearing to determine what has happened.
Sinclair Lewis attended the hearing and made note of the conflicting testimony.
I have sat for hour on hour in the courtroom at the feet of Judge Harding, and I have tried to make out from the witnesses of both sides just what did occur. I have heard that Sheriff Atkins shot down two men, and I have heard that he never even had his pistol loose from its holster. I have heard that the crowd of strikers were an angry and heavily armed mob with sticks and revolvers, and I have heard that there wasn't a single gun among them. The forces of law and order, naturally I mean to say the forces of the sheriff and the mill owners, say that the shooting started from the middle of the road, from amidst the force of strikers, and that the sheriff and his 11 deputies, faced with the murderous mob, had to shoot in return. On the other side, the workers insist that there were no guns and very few clubs among the strikers. They point out that among the 11 deputies and the sheriff, the only injury was a scratch on the cheek of one of the deputies, whereas among the working men, there were 4, then it was 5, who were killed and 20 wounded.
What's going on is a lot of people are giving out information from different points of view, and that basically took up just about all of the days of the hearings, this back and forth with witnesses testifying to basically the same thing over and over again. The final outcome of it, Harding ruled that any man, any deputy that admitted firing his weapon, whether it was in self-defense or not, would have to stand trial for second-degree murder, and it would be up to a jury to determine whether or not it had been self-defense. Anybody that said, "I did not shoot my gun," that was it. They cut him loose right then and there. And the two men that were a point of contention were Sheriff Atkins and Deputy Allie Stepp. Strikers testified that they had seen both of these men firing weapons, but both of these men said, "We never took our guns out of our holster. We never fired it." And Harding basically took their word for it and did not bind either one of them over for trial. The men who did say that they had shot weapons were bound over on second-degree murder charges.
While the hearing was taking place in the McDowell County Courthouse, many Marion residents had turned their attention elsewhere.
When I left the courtroom to buy some cigarettes and to have a cup of coffee, I found that the people of Marion were not talking about the trial. They were talking only about the Baseball World Series. In the restaurant, there was a radio with a loudspeaker. Oh God, how loud that speaker was. How loud. How loud, which was giving the report of the game.
October 11th, 1929 was the last day of the hearing, and the day that Judge Harding ruled that only the deputies who had admitted to firing their weapon would be bound over for trial. It was also the day that striker T.L. Carver died of the wounds that he had received at the mill gate. The 8 deputies charged with second-degree murder were brought to trial in early December. It was decided to move the proceedings out of Marion. Again, author Mike Lawing.
This time they just moved everything out of McDowell County and it went up to Burnsville. At this point, the town of Marion decided they were going to get involved with this. And they took up a collection among all of the store owners and citizens of the town and paid Clyde R. Huey to come in and work with the other attorneys to defend the deputy sheriffs. Now, Clyde Huey was the brother-in-law of Governor O. Max Gardner. He even back then had the idea in his mind that he also might like to be governor of the state. And he was eventually elected governor and then later on went to the United States Senate. He was called the silver-tongued orator of the South. They were going to get this over with before Christmas. That was a guy named Cowper, Judge Vernon Cowper from Kinston was the judge. And he made it clear he wanted this thing settled before Christmas. And they actually had night sessions in the court. There was a lot of testimony from people that strikers were firing weapons. No weapon was ever found. No proof was ever introduced. Anyone ever did have a weapon. One thing that did maybe help a little bit to fix in the jury's mind was T.L. Carver, the last man to die. Dr. Miller did state that when he came in to the hospital, even though he didn't have any guns, there were 4 bullets in his pocket. The jury thought about it. Okay, he doesn't have a gun, but he's got bullets. Why does he have bullets in his pocket? You know, the prosecution never really proved who did it. I mean, other than the fact that these men are firing guns, one of them did it. If they could have maybe focused in a little bit more clearly. But I don't think the prosecution actually made the case that needed to be made for a conviction. The jury, they deliberated on it for a couple of days and then came back and found all of them not guilty.
By the time the trial was over, economic uncertainty had the nation in its grasp. Workers had become much more reluctant to risk losing their jobs through union involvement.
Now, we're in December. Now, by now, the stock market has crashed. The stock market went down the end of October. People really had no idea what was going to happen. So the future was very unsettled. And anybody that had a job was going to do anything they could to keep it. We're putting this in the past. It's over with. We've had the trials. The judge has made his rulings. Now let's all get back to work and put this in the past. And if we've got a job, let's hold on to it. The mill workers were defeated. They knew they were defeated. There was never going to be any way around that. They were gone.
And so the door was closed on this tragic chapter in the history of Marion, in the history of North Carolina, and in the history of the American labor movement. Those who were involved never spoke of it. They didn't tell their children or their grandchildren, and the story of those tumultuous events of 1929 was all but forgotten. McDowell County historian Ann Swan.
The fact that a union was formed was a pretty big thing, that they were able to actually form a union and make it work and to get people to open their eyes to what was happening. But the violence overshadowed that. I think the violence is what's most often remembered. And of course, that left a lot of brokenhearted people. And I think that's the reason why people don't want to talk about it now. I don't agree that the whole thing should just be forgotten, because this was important enough to these workers that they were willing to give their lives. Many of the people who were involved in the union could not stay in the county. They had to go elsewhere to find work.
Roy Price had spearheaded the initial drive to form a union at Marion Manufacturing in early 1929. His son Max recalls that his father had trouble finding work after he was forced to leave Marion because of his organizing activities.
He had to go all the way to Detroit to find work. I don't think the union gained anything. They lost because the natural leaders were all blackballed and pretty much run out of town. Any leadership that was in the mill was pretty much lost. That hurt the mills as well as the people.
Violent uprisings in southern textile mills resurfaced in 1934. There was unrest again in Gaston County. 6 people were killed in Honeyapath, South Carolina. The National Guard was once again sent to Marion to head off any trouble. But there was to be no more union activity in Marion. Textile employees in Marion had had enough trouble, and they were determined to keep their jobs. The textile mills of East Marion, like those all across the South, have fallen silent in recent years.
When I pass the Marion Manufacturing Company building, which is a beautiful old building, and see it empty and will never, I'm sure, be ever used for textiles again, and I think about those people who died on the street in front of that place, and I wonder what they would say if they could know that they gave their lives for something that's no longer there.
Today, the former Clinchfield and Marion Manufacturing Mill villages are decent working-class neighborhoods. Most people who live in the remodeled company houses have no inkling of the events that took place on the streets that they drive every day. On July 4, 2004, Tina Thompson, a tireless champion of the story of the Marion strike, dedicated a monument to the slain workers on the front lawn of the former Marion Manufacturing building, very near to the spot where the shootings took place. The inscription reads, "In memory of the 6 who died fighting for their rights on October 2, 1929. George Jonas, Luther Bryson, Sam Vickers, Randolph Hall, T.L. Carver, and J. Will Roberts." Strike was written and produced by Ellen Furman and Kim Clark, edited by Kim Clark. Special thanks to Mike Lawing, whose book, The Marion Massacre, was a primary source for this program. Thanks also to Ann Swan, Max Price, Don Price, and Jeanette Price. James Richards portrayed Sinclair Lewis, and John Fowler read the lyrics of Woody Guthrie. Our theme song, Cotton Dust, was written by Jay Gorey and performed by The Carburetors. I'm Ellen Furman.
Now they say they might shut down the mill. Profits getting thin. Put 400 people out of work on some bean counter's whim. They say they'll build a new plant down in Mexico. But what good's a fixer if he can't fix that, you know? Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise Him, the Son and the Holy Ghost. If
I die before my shift is through, well, I'll pray the cotton dust carries my soul back to you. Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise Him, the Son and the Holy Ghost. If I die before my shift is through, well, I'll pray the cotton dust carries my soul.